Welcome to the Art Scene and the last program of the 2012-13 season. We'll be off the air in August, but back on the 1st of September. It is brought to you each week by UALR's College of Arts, Humanities and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio. One of the most important and satisfying exhibitions is currently up at the Arkansas Art Center in Little Rock. Rembrandt, Van Dyck, Gainsborough, The Treasures of Kenwood House, London. But it closes September the 8th, which is why Todd Herman, Arkansas Art Center director, came to urge those who have not yet seen it to do so before it's too late. On this, the last stop of a four-city tour of America. The question Todd has been asked most often, and answers again now, is how did Little Rock become one of the four cities?
The exhibition is being circulated by an organization out of New York called the American Federation of Art. They work with large international institutions, whether they're large museums or country houses or whatever the case may be, putting together these pretty sizable exhibitions that travel internationally. So they were contacted by English Heritage about putting together this exhibition of the masterpieces from Kenwood House. And I had worked with the AFA when I was still the chief curator at Columbia, and we had done there an exhibition of work from the museum in Wales, which is famous for its impressionist and post-impressionist paintings. So when I took the position here at Little Rock at the Arkansas Art Center, they called me up and said, well, we had this exhibition called Rembrandt Van Dyck Gainsborough, Treasures from Kenwood House, London, and we were wondering if you would be interested in bringing it to Little Rock, since we had such a good relationship previously when you were in Columbia. I looked over the checklist and, you know, you get to the Rembrandt, you get to the Franz Hals, and you basically want to close the book and write the check and say, let's go. But I looked through the entirety of the checklist, very impressive. At the time, it was a three-venue exhibition. So it was coming to America for the very first time and going to go to three cities only. The first city was already set, and that was Houston. And the final city was already set, and that was Seattle. So they had this middle spot open. And given kind of the past history of the Arkansas Art Center when it comes to big exhibitions, in order to go forward with bringing the show here, I wanted to make sure that I had over 50% of the cost already pledged by sponsors. So I started talking to people, you know, here's an idea, this is the exhibition, I'd like to bring it to Arkansas, this is the time frame, this is how much it costs. Bank of the Ozarks came on first with a major gift, and it snowballed, and I was attempted to get more people. By the time I got to the point that I felt comfortable going forward, the Milwaukee Museum of Art had stepped in and signed the contract on the middle slot. So we were out of luck. A little time goes by. The American Federation of Arts calls me and says, okay, this has not been made public yet, but the renovations on Kenwood House, which is why the exhibition was traveling to begin with, are behind schedule. English Heritage has not announced this yet for political reasons and, you know, marketing PR reasons. But as soon as they do, we will be offering a fourth venue. Are you interested? And I said, absolutely. Well, let me call my sponsors and see if they are still on board with the exhibition. I called them. They were. I called the AFA. I said, as soon as you learn that there's a fourth venue, let me know and let's get moving on the contract. So in the end, I would say that it actually worked out better for us, because the time slot that we ended up with, which is the final venue, aligned more perfectly with our 50th anniversary. It allowed us to be the final venue, which in our marketing materials, we can say last time to see it in the U.S. before it returns, where if you're in the middle, you aren't the venue that opens the show and you're not the venue that closes it. So you're kind of in the middle. And so it worked out very well for us. But we are so, so pleased to have these paintings in Arkansas.
Yes. And I will talk about some of the reactions once you opened and everything. But first of all, a little history on this bequest, the Kenwood House in Hampstead.
It is extremely well known in London because it is free to the public and because it's in Hampstead. The history of the collection is traced to one man, and that is Edward Cecil Guinness, obviously from the last name, from Guinness beer fame. And he didn't necessarily inherit the family fortune. In fact, he was the youngest of three sons, so he quickly realized that he was not likely to inherit the family fortune or the family seat. So he went to work for his father at the brewery at the age of 15, worked his way up, bought out his older brothers, who had married very well and were living the country life of country gentlemen. And by his early 40s, he had increased the company tenfold.
What period of century is?
He took Guinness public in 1886.
Okay.
At which point, he instantly became the wealthiest man in Ireland. So the very next year, 1887, he embarked on a campaign to build a collection to decorate a very, very large home that he and his wife purchased in London as a way to begin to make their mark in English society. By doing that, within the span of 4 years, from 1887 to 1891, he purchased over 200 paintings. So he built the collection very, very quickly. But he managed to find, or in fact, his dealer managed to find great, great examples by the major figures in 17th century and 18th century art.
Amazing, actually. And was Kenwood House the house that they bought?
Kenwood House was not the house that they purchased. He purchased Kenwood House in 1925 with the intention of renovating the inside of the house to house this collection that he had put together. Unfortunately, he died 2 years later and never actually lived in the house, nor were the paintings displayed in the house during his lifetime. But he left the home and the collection to the country with the idea that it be open to the public as an example of a kind of 19th century, early 20th century English country gentleman's home.
Is there any record of his own acuity when it came to choosing paintings, or did he rely entirely on somebody else?
That's actually an interesting question and one that I don't definitively know the answer, but there are a few examples that give us a clue as to his the perception that he had of his capabilities in discerning what art to buy. And one example I will give you is In the exhibition, there is this beautiful self-portrait by Rembrandt from the 1660s, which Guinness purchased. But that's not the first Rembrandt that he bought. He actually bought another Rembrandt early on in his collecting career, even before he started in 1886. He collected things kind of sporadically before that time. And it's an early Rembrandt that he purchased. The issue that he ran into was that there were some scholars who cast doubt at the time on the veracity of that painting, and so he sold it. When he began collecting, he tended to purchase paintings that were famous, had a long track record of being published, of critical acclaim, so that he felt a little bit more certain about spending money by purchasing these works because they were already well known and well accepted. I mean, it's really sad that he didn't trust himself on that first Rembrandt, because it turns out that it is now the Rembrandt Research Project clearly states that it is a 100% Rembrandt painting, and it's really quite gorgeous. It's a religious subject, which again is uncommon for his later collection. His early collection also contained a religious painting by Rubens. So he kind of moved away from that type of painting when he got into 1887 to 1891, that span of his collecting, which is really when it was at its height. He sort of moved away from religious paintings into collecting works that were closer to the two key collections in London at the time, one being the Wallace Collection and the other being the collection of George the Fourth, which were the most famous collections in London and focused on 17th century Dutch portraits and landscapes and 18th century English portraits and landscapes. And so that's kind of where he moved in his collecting. During the run of the exhibition here, we have a couple of programs that look at dance in the time of Rembrandt in the 18th century, and then also music.
You've got one on the 17th with the Arkansas Festival Ballet, don't you?
That is exactly right, yes. August the 17th.
And then you've had quite a few where you've tied it in with some of the popular television series and things.
I mean, Downton Abbey is a wonderful avenue to look at what life would have been like at the time.
And so to interest the public then, you've given insight into the young man in question. And what a pity that he didn't have enough confidence to go with some of his instinctive choices the early years of his collecting. What kind of a collection this one might have been, but it sounds as though it was a pretty impressive one anyway.
It is a very impressive collection. There are so many things to learn from this exhibition. You can obviously look at each of the individual paintings and admire them for the talent of the artist, for the technique, for the vision, for the creativity. You can admire them for the history in each of the paintings, especially in the portraits. Who were these people? What were their lives like? I mean, it brings a different generation to life. But also there is the story about a man, and I believe probably his wife as well, building a collection at a time when people like Henry Clay Frick, J. Pierpont Morgan, the Rothschilds were putting together their collections at the same time. And they were all going after the same mm-hmm. kinds of paintings. Now Guinness got there he started a few years earlier. So he was able to kind of get the pick better than some of his American counterparts.
How old was he when he started this?
He would have been in his late 30s or early 40s, probably. I think it's early 40s.
When he decided as the third son in succession to the family fortunes and the business, he must have been quite a young man to make the decision not to be the third son and get to go off and the things that bored young men with too much money and frustration because they didn't think they were going to be much value in regard to the family. Made his peace with it and used his own talents to pursue what made his life possible.
He really did. At the age of 15, he went to work in the family business and he worked his way up. And I think he realized that that was his pathway.
These are some of the things that you're bringing out during the course of this exhibit and when the people go around. But you've got 48 paintings
yes.
with backgrounds, different as far as subject matter mm-hmm. and artist and period when they were bought. And that would probably factor into whatever texts were put in context with the various paintings.
Yes, there are many stories to be told in this exhibition, and not all of them can be explored to the depth that many of us would like in the context of an exhibition and a limited number of text panels. So, for example, we look briefly at the history of Kenwood House itself.
What has been the reaction of most of the people going round it? Have you had good crowds in to see it?
We have had very good crowds, and the reactions are of a type where visitors are kind of stunned to see these paintings in Little Rock, Arkansas. And the way the exhibition is arranged, when you come through the doors and you have the title wall in front of you and some information about Kenwood House and some of its earlier owners, you kind of turn the corner and there's the Rembrandt in front of you on its own wall in all of its glory. And it kind of gives you an instant wow factor.
And this is the main gallery off the atrium?
Exactly. The main gallery off the atrium to the left, the Jeanette Idris Rockefeller Galleries and the Townsend Wolf Galleries. That takes up both of those spaces. Again, to get back to the reactions of the visitors, once you get past the kind of awe-inspiring vision of that Rembrandt portrait, you can then kind of take in the ambiance. And people have said that it's the most beautiful exhibition they've ever seen at the Arkansas Art Center. They can't believe the size and scale of some of these works. They can't believe how beautiful they are. They can't believe that the show is actually here.
You've just got a few weeks left, so you're not planning any big farewell to the exhibit.
Oh, yes, we are. The final day, Sunday, September 8th, we have a last call. So it is last call for the exhibition, and we will be serving Guinness. It's a big party to say goodbye to the paintings, not only as they leave the Arkansas Art Center, but leaving America.
Of course, yes.
Because their next stop is on the walls at Kenwood House.
That was Todd Herman, director of the Arkansas Art Center. Rembrandt van Dyck Gainsborough, The Treasures of Kenwood House, London, closes September the 8th. Various activities have been planned around this exhibit, and there are still some to come. This weekend, for example, has been devoted to Downton Abbey, and today, starting at 11 a.m., you can see Series 3 through to 8 p.m. And then in August, several special lectures and two Kenwood House-style dinners on August the 8th and 29th. And the closing gala on September the 8th. For details, visit arkansasartcenter.org. And for other events around the state and in the city, don't forget to visit our online calendar at ualrpublicradio.org. The second part of today's program is all about 2013-14 in the Theatre Squared season. My guests are Bob Ford and Martin Miller, respectively Artistic Director and Managing Director of the Northwest Arkansas Repertory Theatre and Resident Company at the Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. They joined me earlier this spring for the 2013 New Play Festival, which I'm told met all expectations. And we all look forward to that program coming to Little Rock, sponsored by Arkansas Rep next year when we can share the 2014 New Play Festival. Now we get some background on the Theatre Squared 2013-14 five-play season, which opens August the 29th with The Spiritualist by Robert Ford, which was featured in the 2012 New Play Festival, so we have Bob Ford, the playwright, to lead us on. Where did you find it, and what's it about?
Yeah, inspired by a real individual in London in 1971 who claimed to channel the music of dead composers.
How did you come upon it?
Years ago, when I was first courting my wife, Amy, who is now playing this role, she found this in the Dixon Street bookshop in Fayetteville, a book called Unfinished Symphonies. Said, hey, I think this might make a terrific play, this, you know, with this intriguing character. And she told me about it, immediately caught my fancy, and has been sort of on the back burner for quite a while.
So then you move from that to what sounds as though it could be a combination of comedy and something a little bit more serious. 4,000 Miles.
We had to put this in one of the categories. I'd call this a comic drama. It's a beautiful play that's heartwarming and has a lot of very smart writing, smart comic writing in it, but really goes to the heart of what it means to come to terms with loss and with opening up as a young man, opening up to family and opening up your heart. Tips it over in the drama category, but it's a lovely, very funny show.
And it has the appeal of being intergenerational as well, from the sound of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Appealing to elders as well as college-age kids, because the main two characters straddle that.
The play was a finalist for the 2013 Pulitzer Prize.
Uh-huh.
So it's a very new play. It's had a few productions around the country, and so we're glad to kind of bring it quickly to Arkansas.
A little bit about the story of that. It's about a young man who's not sure what he wants and goes out looking for it. What is the idea?
You know, without giving away important pieces of the plot, he's a young man who's very much searching for his next step. He's not interested in college. He's an outdoors kind of guy. He's having trouble in his romantic relationship. And he shows up at the apartment of his grandmother, who he's also, you know, somewhat distant from, but clearly in need of some human connection because of some things that went on this 4,000-mile bike trip. We watched this lovely relationship blossom between him and his grandmother, both of whom have very different interests in life, but are connected by family and by sort of mutual need. Add to that, Martin?
I think that's a good summation. There's an inherent comedy, obviously, to the sort of odd couple pairing of these two people from two such different generations, but there's also a real sweetness to it. Reading the play, and I suspect much more seeing the play, which I know you have, Bob, you know, you'll walk out feeling that mix of emotions and also having been glad to have just been there for it.
You too are obviously closely involved in making the choices. Do you have others putting in commentaries when you're not quite sure you'd like to bring somebody else in on some of the decisions? Or do the two of you pretty much have total control as to what gets put on?
Oh, no. We talk to at least half a dozen people who are really close to the theater. And of course, the decision ultimately is made by our artistic staff. And I include Martin, obviously, in this. So Martin, myself, and Morgan Hicks and Amy Herzberg, who's the associate artistic director. That's sort of the decision finally lies. I suppose I'm the backstop. If it's really a tie, I'm the last word, but rarely comes to that. It usually becomes a consensus around the titles. And then all of us are talking all the time to a group of people who we've worked with and trust a lot, and also our eyes and ears in Chicago and New York, and are seeing plays that we don't get a chance to see. You know, 6-month-long conversation. And that conversation started probably 6 weeks ago for the 2014-15 season.
Yes, you have
to,
yes.
We're already looking ahead to that.
Now, the third one is Christmas Carol. It says original, which I look at with a question mark, and new with lots of exclamation marks.
We're not going to spoof it, not this time around. We've never done a Christmas Carol. We did Jacob Marley's Christmas Carol, which is a lovely show from Jacob Marley's perspective. We've never done a straight-up Christmas Carol, and we'd like to bring the Dickens sensibility to our first production of it.
Well, that's a very good thought because, yes, Christmas Carol in its various disguises, but it also is done straight as it was originally planned by the writer. So it would be nice to see what it is you do with it to make it
exactly
new.
Yeah, I think what we do well is this intimacy because people are so close to the acting and to the characters and the people that are up there. And that's where the, now, in addition to, you know, everyone who does the Christmas Carol does an adaptation that is in some way its own adaptation, and that is what we will do. So in that, as respectively new, but the other newness will be for people to see this up close and with real people just a few feet away acting out an amazingly theatrical story that does everything that we say we want to do at Theater Squared, kind of redeem the human story, the human heart. And that's why this play, people come back year after year to see this story. We want to rediscover every lovely moment in the play. So that's how we will make it fresh and new.
So that gives a very definite perspective of the type of actors you're choosing to play the parts.
Yes, that has a huge influence on who we pick. There's an actor who loves connecting with the other actors on stage and being fully and kind of honestly in the emotional moments of the play, and most actors strive for that. That's really, really what we go for.
You've been doing some auditioning for the season, presumably. Are you looking at some of those? Have you sort of got certain ones that you've watched perform in your various cattle calls, or whatever they call them, to call back nearer the time that suit your ideal of what you want?
It's a terrible word, but it's really so useful, and that is we really do have a stable of actors who we we love and know that we can rely on for this kind of acting. And so for the whole season, really, there are, you know, here and there places where we have kind of a bench of actors that we know will go to. And the same thing holds true for Christmas Carol.
Right. Then moving from Christmas Carol to Good People, and then I read the little bit of blurb about the play. It made me think of that saying that no good deed goes unpunished.
That's a good blurb for that play. Yeah, Martin, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
What are your thoughts about Good People? I've been talking a lot.
My first read of Good People, it was interesting because most of the time you're reading a play for the season, you sit down and you read a bit and you come back and you read a bit. And this particular play seemed to beg for me to just keep going. And so I did read it in the sitting. I think that speaks well for what this story really is, which is kind of an edge-of-your-seat family individual drama, you know, and with a lot of kind of comedy interspersed. You know, it was a Tony Award finalist just a couple years back on Broadway. It's the newest play by David Lindsay Abaire, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright. And it's just the intensely personal drama of the main woman in this show, who lives in South Boston. And her name is Margie, and she is just trying to meet the next week's, you know, get the next week's paycheck to meet the next week's bills. And it's very much, you root for her, and you're also ashamed of her, but you're in love with her. It's a very complicated relationship by the end of the show, and I think that's what makes it great theater.
There are two deadly words in theater: social drama. And this is very much a social drama, but it is brilliantly funny and taut. And I think Martin is right, edge of your seat. But one of the things that I love about this play are the social truths that it tells us about our society, things that we, I think, need to look at about our class system. And this puts us there in a really entertaining way. But it's good old crackling drama.
So you end your season, and this is something that I find very intriguing because the rep didn't quite start with Hamlet, but it was a very significant play in the early part of the season, and you've placed it as the final play of your 2013-14 season.
Being in a region where that does not have regular Shakespeare productions, it's really a sad thing. What we kind of wanted to do with Hamlet, even though we're a theater that mostly prides ourselves on our voice and contemporary work, is to start the ball rolling and say, and get people to be like, yeah, we want more Shakespeare and we want it live. It's totally different than you read it on the page. So I guess we're doing more than just Hamlet in a way. We are saying, we're staking a claim for Shakespeare in our region and hoping that it inspires more Shakespeare on a continuing basis. The rep has blazed a good trail there, but we haven't seen as much in Northwest Arkansas. And then why Hamlet? I guess we thought if you're going to do one Shakespeare play, you might as well do what arguably might be his finest work. You know, just in terms of, as you said, the sheer human quotient, that play, much like Next to Normal, is a feel-everything show.
Bob Ford, Artistic Director, and Managing Director Martin Miller for Theatre Squared, the Northwest Arkansas Repertory Company, based in the Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. The Theatre Squared season opens August the 29th with the world premiere of Robert Ford's The Spiritualist running through September the 15th. For tickets and more information, visit theatre2.org/subscribe. That concludes this week's program and the Arts Scene 2012-13 season. We will be off the air in August, returning September the 1st, bringing you, our audience, much to look forward to in the year ahead. My grateful thanks are to all who helped me get the Art Scene coming. In particular, William Wagner is my linchpin, and Ben Fry untangles the terrifying errors that keep coming. Karen Trico-Seward, Malcolm Glover, Nathan Vandiver, Michael Hiblin, and Chris Hickey keep my spirits up, while Mary Waldo and Benita Moorwood make sure I mind my manners. To all of the staff, my gratitude. And to all of you, thank you for listening. I'm Ann Nicholson.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR's College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio.